Tonight's scripture is from the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 43 through 51. The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him about whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph, from Nazareth." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." When Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him, he said of him, "Here is truly an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael asked him, "Where did you get to know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered, "Do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." The word of the Lord.
It was the final year of Obama's first term. It seemed pretty clear that he would be elected to a second term. The country was in full recovery mode from the Great Recession. The housing market was nearly recovered, and you didn't really hear about the president every day. Certainly, the president wasn't leading the news every day. And definitely, the president wasn't breaking news like several times a day. It was a different time. And that was the last time we preached year two of the lectionary. Okay, I know that that is really a letdown after that introduction to end on that. I know it's a disappointing conclusion. I know it was a pretty big buildup just to mention the last time we preached year two of the lectionary. But if I started my sermon saying, "It's been a long time since we preached year two of the lectionary," people would stop paying attention right away. Like, using the phrase, "It's been a long time," and "preached" in the opening sentence of your sermon is just like releasing like sleeping gas into the sanctuary, you know? It's just like handing out pillows and blankets to everybody before I preach the sermon. You know, so you have to forgive me, you know? So I used some words and phrases that I knew would pull you particularly in, would tug at your minds and engage your hearts. You know, like words like Obama's first term, you know? I mean, even now you know I'm doing that to you, but you still feel it. It still works, you know? Obama's first term. Obama's first term. I mean, can't you just feel the endorphins rush through you just when I say it? And then, you know, and then I take that good feeling and then I make this comparison. I say something like, "The president certainly wasn't leading the news every day, and definitely the president wasn't breaking news several times a day," which makes you a little mad, which releases adrenaline. So the two together, like the adrenaline, the endorphins, it's like a neurological speedball. So you're here with me. So that's how long ago it was that we preached year two of the lectionary. And I guess when it's been a while since you've studied a text, you notice things in it that you didn't see before. A different shade, a nuance. When I read today's text about Jesus calling Philip and Nathanael, this time I noticed that Philip totally got punked. And it affected his attitude for the rest of his disciplehood. It affected his whole legacy. I mean, you know, the text that we read today, Jesus goes to Galilee, and he sees Philip first, and he says to Philip, follow me, which is great, because Philip is like, he's like a full believer guy, he's like a positive guy, and he's just a good guy. So, you know, he doesn't just rush after Jesus, he goes and finds his buddy, Nathanael, and he's like, we've found the Messiah. He doesn't say, I found the Messiah, I'm sure you know, he's like, he includes him even, we found the Messiah. And Nathanael's like, what? You know, Nathanael's kind of negative. And he's like, no, it's this, it's Jesus of Nazareth. And Nathanael's like, what good can come from Nazareth? No, he's like, just come and see. He's very excited. So they're going to see Jesus. And Jesus sees, not Philip, Nathanael coming. And Jesus says to Nathanael, here truly is an Israelite in which there is no deceit. And Nathanael's like, How do you get to know me? And Jesus said, I saw you sitting under that fig tree before Philip even called you. And Nathanael replies, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And Jesus throws his arm around Nathanael and they start walking. And Jesus says, do you believe in me because I told you I saw you under the fig tree? You'll see greater things than this. And, you know, Philip's trying to catch up with him. He's in the back there, you know, and get involved in the conversation. And she's like, yes, I tell you, you'll see heaven open and angels of God ascending and descending to the Son of Man. And Philip's like, is that just apply to him? Or well, am I going to be seeing that too? Or, you know, totally ignore him. They just move on. Philip is the guy who Jesus told to follow him. He was just letting Nathanael in to be a good guy. And now Jesus doesn't even notice him? I mean, come on. Jesus doesn't even notice him? Nathanael was the one who said, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And did Philip tell Jesus that he said that? No. No, of course not. He wouldn't do that. No. Because that would not be cool. Not be cool like perhaps if like your best friend and your newly discovered Messiah just ignored you and went off together. Not cool. But, you know, this thing, it makes him feel bad. He doesn't really know how to deal with it. He can't let go of it, Philip. He kind of gets negative. Like the next time we hear about Philip mentioned in John's gospel is the feeding of the 5,000. And Jesus turns to Philip and he says, where are we going to find bread for all these people to eat? Now, this would be a great time for Philip to turn things around. Jesus is speaking to him. Jesus is singling him out. He's giving him some responsibility. Philip could say, hey, I'm on it. Don't worry about it. You know, I will take care of it. I'll figure it out. Maybe even get himself a little, when he's finished, get a little, well done, my good and faithful servant, you know? But no, he doesn't. When Jesus says to him, where are we going to find bread for all these people to eat? Philip says, I don't know. It would take like 6 months' salary to buy bread for all these people, and they wouldn't even get very much. Come on, Philip. This is like discipling 101. Always say yes and. Then the next time Philip gets a mention is when these Greeks come they want to see Jesus. So they come up to Andrew and they say, we've heard about Jesus and this was, we'd really like to see him. And Nathanael doesn't like say, yeah, he's amazing, like he did at the beginning. With Nathanael, he says, wait here. And then he goes and says to Andrew, these guys, they want to see Jesus. And then Andrew's like, well, let's go bring him to Jesus. I mean, he's lost it. And then after that is like Jesus talking about when he's going to be crucified and die. And he's talking about how he and the Father are one. And Philip says, okay, well, just show us the Father then. And then we'll believe you. And Jesus says to him, how long have you been with me, Philip? And you still don't know me? Whenever you see me, you see the Father. How can you say to me, show us the Father? Philip is not doing himself any favors here. There's even this legend that after the resurrection, but before Jesus ascends into heaven, Jesus appears to the disciples for this time and spends this time with the disciples, like staying with them and teaching them. before sending them out to preach the gospel to the world. But right in the middle of this, before Jesus sends them out, Philip goes off on his own and starts discipling people. And even when Jesus, before he ascends, they send word to Philip to come back. And he doesn't do it. He's just like, I don't know, he's got something to prove or what. He's frankly hard to be around. And then this was too perfect when I read this. I read, Philip is actually the patron saint of haters. I mean, I know it's perfect. Well, it's too perfect. I misread it. He's the patron saint of hatters. Philip is a patron saint of hatters, not haters. But I was almost finished with my sermon when I realized the mistake, so I just left all that hater stuff in. Besides, hatters? Come on. I mean, were they making hats? You know, like, try too hard much? Like, they need a saint to help them out even? Come on. Whatever. Philip is just that guy in the 12 disciples. He's the hater character. You know, like every reality TV show has this hater character. It's like this could be the reality TV show, like, you know, the 12, you know, like who will get the keys to the kingdom and who will be the first to betray him. Yeah, every reality TV show has this hater guy, you know. They never win, but they always make it like to the final three, you know, because they need that character who's like this hater, so the audience can kind of hate them, but righteously, you know, feel good about it. Like, it's just like, okay, Philip, already, I just hate that Philip, man. Like, get crucified upside down already, you know? Which is how he dies, actually. He's crucified upside down with Nathanael, if you can believe it. And he preaches while they're hanging upside down. Philip does. And it's so moving that they let Nathanael go. I'm serious. There's just something about Nathanael. People love him, you know? He's like, he's got a good personality. He's handsome. He's just compelling somehow, you know? Even the crucifiers loved him. So they let him go. So the hater character, this is just like, the hater character is like this perpetual adolescent, you know? And adolescents, they don't know how to navigate the world yet, you know? They don't know who they are. They are still figuring these things out. So they're often reactive and emotional, and their hormones are like coursing through them and transforming them into adults, and they don't know what's going on. It's hard to control their emotions, and they're narcissistic and irrational and clumsy and scattered. Which is all a necessary stage of development. It's all good and healthy when you're an adolescent. But one hopefully develops into a healthy adult who understands that you don't always get what you want. You learn to compromise. You learn to think of other people, to have empathy for them. I mean, if somebody slights you, you give them the benefit of the doubt. You think, well, they're having a bad day, or I'm sure they didn't mean it. You know, like an adult. And, I mean, I think we all know, even as well-adjusted adults, that we sometimes can act like adolescents. And frankly, you know, some of us more than others. I mean, I know I am guilty of acting like an adolescent, probably more than most of you. I know this because my teenagers tell me all the time. They say, you're being kind of adolescent, to which I say, you yelled at me first, and besides, I was already watching something. And while everyone can act like an adolescent sometimes, they do, we all act like adolescents sometimes, but the adults in our lives are understanding. They're understanding of that. But it seems like now, though, that as a nation, we have like rushed into this return to adolescence. And you know, just like dealing with actual adolescence, when someone is behaving like an adolescent, it makes a lot more work for the adults. Like when you ask an adolescent, maybe, you know, like to make dinner, because you want to teach them like responsibility and, you know, to contribute to the family or whatever. And then you go into the kitchen when they're done, and you just like cannot believe that the kitchen could ever be this messy. It's like a disaster. Like every pot is dirty. All the cupboards are open. And it looks like a bomb went off in there, you know? And you think like, it would be so much less work for me if I just made dinner myself. Or, you know, it's like when you ask an adolescent to engage in international diplomacy, and then you see what they've done, and you're just like, what did you do? How could you make this big of a mess? Do you know how long it's going to take to clean this up? And, like, hopefully it doesn't look like a bomb just went off. This return to adolescence is like insidious. It's contagious. When everybody's kind of acting like an adolescent and talking like an adolescent, sometimes it's hard not to respond like an adolescent. Like more and more of our good citizens seem to be abandoning adulthood and embracing this like reactionary, me-centered rhetoric. We need the adults back. When we need less hating. We need more mercy. Haters don't, they're not acting out of some kind of love or anything like that. Haters don't feel good. Forgiveness is not an adolescent act. You know, the way out of our new national adolescence really is the practice of radical mercy and gratitude. Radical mercy and gratitude are transformative. They transform the person who practices this radical mercy and gratitude, and they transform the person who receives this radical mercy and gratitude. Because when you're showing mercy and being grateful, it's like impossible to be an asshole at the same time. What, I can't say asshole? I know, it's very adolescent. I was going to say shithole, but I didn't. It's very adolescent. I'm sorry, that is very adolescent. And I should be better than that. So I'm sorry about that. It's hard sometimes to be an adult. It's hard sometimes to act with mercy and gratitude. I mean, that is why it's called practice, right? It's hard to be an adult. Yes, I am saying that Jesus wants you to be a well-adjusted adult. We need all of them we can get. And when it's hard, this can help.